So I'm joined now by Ron Nairig, former chairman of the California Republican Party and involved in a really interesting argument about how the party applies its endorsement to candidates, which I'd love to talk about, Ron. Great to see you.
Good to see you.
And also more widely about your reflections on this event and where the party stands. But
sure.
First, tell us about this interesting change that you're pushing for.
Yeah, so under some rules that were adopted about 12 years ago, the California Republican Party since then has endorsed some pretty embarrassing candidates.
Right.
One who's a Holocaust denier, says the Holocaust did not happen, said the Israeli government was behind 9/11. Another candidate who we endorse is now facing...
By the way, these days that could get you into a presidential primary perfectly well.
This other candidate who we endorsed has now been indicted on 43 felony counts.
Ooh.
And in neither of these cases did we vote to endorse this candidate.
Right.
This is automatic under a very flawed rule that we have,
right.
Loophole, which means that if you are the only Republican candidate in the top two under our jungle primary system,
yes,
then you automatically have the party's endorsement. No vetting, no vote, nothing.
If you're the only Republican.
Correct. And so
that's happened, really interesting. I wasn't aware of.
Yeah. So what's happened in some of these heavily Democratic districts,
yes,
which are not competitive and,
yeah,
quality candidates very often don't run, it's some lunatic who winds up, you know, running and just filing. And because the voters don't know the name of that candidate,
mm-hmm,
Republican voters in that district, well, that's the Republican, I'll vote for the Republican.
Right.
And so they really just fall into being in the top two. They
right.
have no chance of winning, but it becomes a national embarrassment for the Republican.
Because nobody's actually vetted them. No one's...
Correct.
Okay.
And there's no vote. And therefore, no one at the Republican Party can actually be held accountable for endorsing this guy.
Right.
Because, well, it was automatic. We can't do anything about it. It was automatic. So our goal has been to change this and
right.
end these zombie endorsements.
Yes.
So that every time that you endorse someone who's not previously been elected as a Republican,
uh-huh,
it requires a vote. It should require.
Right. And therefore, who takes the vote?
Well, it could be either the board of directors or the executive committee or
the
full committee.
State party.
Right, of the state
not,
party.
Not a county party.
The county parties under the law have their own independent system for endorsing.
I see. This
only applies to the state
party.
Statewide,
got it.
Right.
Okay.
And so we want to make sure that when someone walks away with that Republican Party endorsement, somebody's accountable. And because
yes.
somebody's accountable, someone's going to be careful in terms of who they vote to give that
yes.
endorsement to so that they're not endorsing the Nazi, the Holocaust denier, the fraudster, etc.
Yes.
Yeah.
Really interesting. I mean, it's so fascinating how over time these rules are adopted, sometimes with good intentions, and they're not deliberately trying to cause a problem, but then the way things work out,
right.
you get these unintended consequences.
Right, which is why you have to then be able to come back and make
yeah.
changes accordingly. By the way, in Europe, this would never happen because European political parties have so much more control
yes.
over who their candidates are and the ability to protect the party brand. In the corporate world, you'd call this brand safety.
Yeah.
You know, nobody wants their ad for soap to appear next to someone making a post online with a swastika.
Yes.
Right? So nobody wants that affiliation. And we have to be careful about who we choose to affiliate with as a party,
mm-hmm.
particularly in these districts where there's no real competition on the Republican side because it's such a heavily Democratic
yes.
district. And unfortunately, in our state, there are a lot of districts like that.
Yes. So just to be clear, it's not about political vetting or policy positions or anything like that.
Right.
Because I do hear from people that sort of, you grumble, this is the classic thing you hear in parties all the time, I'm very familiar with it, grumbling about, you know, that they're sort of not endorsing conservatives or they are endorsing these people.
Yeah.
It's not about that. It's about it's actually just making sure there is some kind of vetting
right.
at all.
So I've worked in the conservative movement for 30 years. I'm a lifelong conservative. I'm a conservative on every issue down the line. I support a conservative party platform, et cetera. What I don't support is just giving our endorsement to any
yeah.
Yahoo who shows up who doesn't share our Republican values at all. There's nothing Republican or conservative about being an anti-Semite or about being a fraudster.
But the opposite.
These run contrary to solid Republican
exactly.
conservative values. And we need to make sure that at least someone is looking at these candidates and not putting the party on the Tesla self-drive mode and you know, wind up in the back of a bridge.
It's a great way of putting it. I mean, it seems totally unobjectionable. Are there any objections?
Oh, sure, because there are some people who are just vested in how, you know, how we do things. Maybe they helped to write the rule as it was before,
mm-hmm.
or maybe they have some other motive. But unfortunately, you know, our proposal was defeated in the Rules Committee yesterday. And the party will now sleepwalk into another.
So this is over?
Yeah, well, it's effectively over for now.
I didn't realize. I'm so sorry. I thought that the vote lay ahead, and I was talking to you in the hope that it might pass, because it seems to me an entirely sensible thing to do.
It is a sensible thing to do, and that's why it's a big setback, because now the party will sleepwalk into another election cycle.
Where have you got these?
Where you face these risks.
Excuse me. Yeah. Wow.
In the UK, this would never happen. Because the parties in the UK have so much more control over who their candidate
is. I remember it very well. In the party. And, you know, it's a difficult balance. You know, for example, I remember back in the day, one of our first real initiatives in terms of party management, when David Cameron, who I worked for, senior advisor, was elected leader, was to try and change the profile of our candidates. Again, not from a political perspective, but from a representational perspective, because we had some appalling imbalance in terms of members of parliament who were conservatives, something like 300 men and 4 women, something And so we made a real effort to try and to make sure we considered and recruited more women to run and be considered and so on. And, you know, that ran into a lot of opposition because there was this sense that we were imposing something. And we tried to be creative in designing systems that would result in women being selected as candidates, without actually forcing a particular person.
Right. Well, that's very ambitious. We're just trying to make sure that we're not sleepwalking into endorsing some Nazi or some fraudster, or literally somebody who's been indicted on 43 felony counts of using their campaign for personal financial gain.
All right. So we'll follow it. You're going to keep at it, I guess. So what are your thoughts just generally now, as someone who's, you know, been at this for a long time and been in the thick of it here in California? The state of the party, prospects for Republicans across the state?
You know, I think we're in a really tough spot here in California. Look, again, I'm a movement conservative. I want to see conservative ideas advance, but that has to be done in a way that is going to win over people who are not currently voting for us.
Yes.
And the Republican Party brand nationally works pretty well. We hold the House, we're close in the Senate, we've held the White House a bunch. The National Party brand works very well. The National Party brand in California works well in some places, but it does not work well in most places in the state.
Yes.
I'm a local elected official in San Diego County. My district is 52% Republican because I'm 30 miles from the coast. The further you get from the coast, the more conservative it is, but the fewer people you have. And so we need a National Party brand that is conservative, offers solutions to problems that people are facing, but is also going to work in suburbia. And the number one demographic group in California is suburban voters, because the state is overwhelmingly suburban.
Yes.
And those voters tend to be a little bit more educated. They tend to be married with families. They either own a home or they want to own a home.
Yes.
We have to offer a National Party brand that speaks to them and that speaks to the challenges that they are facing here in California. And I think a lot of the fights that we're having here this weekend are about national issues that are already resolved in our federal National Party platform.
Yes.
We have to focus here on offering solutions to people who live in L.A. and Orange County and San Diego and the Inland
Side, Little South,
et cetera.
Well, I couldn't agree more. That's literally why we're sitting in front of a banner that says Golden Together, because that's the entire point of this organization and on our first big initiative, which is to address the housing crisis.
Yes.
And the fact that the dream of home ownership has just disappeared in California effectively.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't agree more. Well, I was interested in everything you just said there I agree with. That is my analysis too. But you use the term that national brand.
Right.
To what extent do you think it could be possible for Californians, Republicans, to forge a California brand that works here? Because in a sense, we don't have control over the national
brand. Right. And that's really tough, because in the American political system, the political parties are defined nationally. Because if you compare the amount of news coverage that comes out of Washington on any given day to the amount of coverage that comes out of Sacramento, it's overwhelming, right? So what happens in Washington defines the party overwhelmingly. And the person who defines the party more than anyone else is the presidential nominee every 4 years. And so what happens right now is that you can be the Republican presidential nominee and not win California.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need a National Party brand that works in California if your goal is just to win the White House. But if you want to build a truly national party that wins a mandate, not just an election. Look, we've been winning elections, you know, since Ronald Reagan in terms of my political history. And our national debt is higher than it's ever been before. Yet we've had Republican presidents, Republican congresses, and the national debt keeps going. Why? Because we win elections, but we don't win a mandate. We don't want an outright majority of all of the American people.
Right.
And we need a national party brand that is not just adequate to win a majority in the Electoral College for president. We need a party brand that will win us a mandate from a majority of the American people, of all the American people, not just those who vote. Right. And so what we've done is we've really figured out, well, how can we win an election without winning a majority? Right. The last Republican presidential candidate to win a majority of the popular vote was George W. Bush in 2004.
Yes.
And one presidential election after another, even when we've won the White House, we've not won a majority of the American people. And without that majority, you just don't have a mandate under our system. And what happens?
Interesting.
The national debt goes up.
That's such an interesting way of thinking about it. I mean, I've got, you know, I think about it from a California perspective because that's my focus.
Mm-hmm.
My way into that argument would be to say, actually, there is a national interest for Republicans and conservatives in helping to design a brand that works, that starts off working in California.
Right.
Because then you know that it'll appeal elsewhere. But also, from a policy point of view, so many of the things that Republicans and conservatives battle on the national stage, whether that's climate extremism or extremism on crime and so on, these things originate in California.
Right.
So actually, beating them in California is a way of stopping them nationwide.
And I'll tell you when that's going to happen. When the demographics in Texas make Texas truly competitive and not just slam dunk for Republicans, then the Electoral College map is going to change. And then all of a sudden, nationally, if you're running a presidential campaign, well, we have a problem. We have to be competitive in some places. And until you can't win the presidency without California, then just somebody's going to make a rational decision and say, well, it's easier for us to get these other states rather than in California. But you're right. The big battles that we have to fight are the ones that are being fought here. And we have to figure out how to win on these battles here and then take that national.
I, again, couldn't agree more. So looking at all of that and looking ahead to this cycle and the ones after, I mean, what do you see as the prospects for Republicans in California?
Well, I think part of that involves making the state very relevant in the primary process.
Right.
We need Californians who share that vision that you and I have talked about, that we have a national party brand that will work in California, and to take that to the highest levels in the next Republican presidential campaign, regardless of who that is. Mm-hmm. I'm agnostic. I haven't endorsed a candidate. I want whoever the Republican nominee is to help us build a party brand that wins in suburbia.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we win in suburbia, regardless of whether it's the Atlanta suburbs or the Cleveland suburbs or the LA suburbs, if we have a brand that works in suburbia, we have a brand that's going to work in California.
Great. It's a great, simple focus.
But if we have a brand that's only working in West Texas, or it's only working in East San Diego County, where I live, which is like West Texas, then we're not going to build a majority.
Yeah.
Only if you get a majority are you able to do the things that we have to do. But we have to stop focusing on only winning an election. We have to win a mandate.
Yes.
And I think the biggest challenge we have because of social media is that we have all these people who've basically trained themselves to think about politics the way they run a Twitter account. And that is, you double down on everything. There's no persuasion happening on Twitter.
Yeah.
Nobody's persuading anybody. And we have forgotten how to persuade people.
We're
approaching people, and on 10 issues, can we find the one that we agree on and make the relationship about
like
that?
This is why I'm talking about housing. It's an issue that brings people together. It's a really, you know, and I'm seeing it every day as we're going around talking to people and trying to build the coalition.
On
it's
Twitter,
like that.
If there are 10 issues and you disagree with someone on 9 of them, on Twitter, you pound away at them on what you disagree on. But that's not what candidates have to do. Candidates have to flip that around. We have to find the one issue we agree on. One fish, one hook. We have to find that one issue that we agree on and then make the relationship about that and only about that. And say, oh, we disagree on other things, but let's focus on this and get in the sun.
Such a great way of looking at it. Just reminds me of one thing when you're talking about Twitter, X, I think we're now supposed to.
Right.
And we will be canceled by Elon Musk if we get the name wrong. Just reflecting on the fact that in some of the commentary around Senator Feinstein's death, we're speaking the day after that was announced, the news of that. One of the things that was said was that in the very early days of Twitter, she was absolutely dead against it. And spoke to the Democrat at all meeting in the Senate, and she said, we must not go on this as senators. We should not be on this. And I think the way she put the question, according to someone who's there, was like, how are we serving our constituents by being on this day and tweeting and spending our time doing this? An interesting perspective.
Yeah, I think that it can also be a crutch in that if you're on Twitter, you're just throwing stuff out there and you're not being challenged on it effectively. And unfortunately, we have so many people who their idea of politics is, well, I'm going to run my campaign the way I run a Twitter
account. Yes.
It's two very different things.
Yeah.
It's two very different spheres. If we're not in the persuasion business and the majority business, then we're not in any business, then we're out of business. And in California, that's the attitude our candidates have to have. Mm-hmm. How do I think majority?
Mm-hmm.
If I find someone who I disagree with, I have to find what I agree with a lot and make it about that and appeal to that.
So last question. We've talked a lot about the brand and the message, and very much a focus area for me and the policies that underpin that and the policy focus. What about the mechanics of elections? That matters enormously as well.
Yeah.
Just, you know, the basics of registering people to vote and so on. How do you feel that's going in terms of the politics performance? This must have been something you spent a lot of time on.
So in my day job, I work for a conservative NGO called the Leadership Institute, and we train conservatives around the country and around the world in campaigns, in what we call political technology, the ability to organize and communicate.
Yes.
That's what we teach. So leadershipinstitute.org, and we are running an aggressive training program in California to train candidates, activists, and campaigners to with the skills that they need in order to fight and win in the public policy arena. There's much more of that has to be done.
Yeah.
Because you have a whole generation of younger people coming up to the political system who have not been trained in that. Their counterparts on the left have been trained in that by the labor unions and left-wing NGOs and so on. And if all you've learned about how politics works is how you interact on Facebook and Twitter, you're in big trouble, because that's not how you win a majority. That's how you talk to a group of people who already agree with you.
Yeah.
And so Leadership Institute is working hard. It's nonpartisan. It's focused, aimed at conservatives, not people in one political party, but it's aimed at conservatives. And we need much more of that. We also have to build, the Republican Party has to build grassroots infrastructure into every neighborhood. The most important person in the Republican Party is not the candidate. It's not the chairman. It's definitely not the former chairman. The most important person in the Republican Party is the precinct volunteer, the person who goes and knocks on the door of their neighbor, not just some random house, you know, on the other side of town, but their neighbor. They make the Republican Party personal. That's a human being standing on my doorstep in this digital world. Analog is cut, right? If they, the human being standing on the doorstep, bringing that Republican message, and they're smiling and they look nice and like, wow, that's different than what I might see in the media or how my left-wing opponent is portraying Republicans and so on. We have to get on people's doorsteps, and it needs to be by a neighbor, not just some paid walker, not some paid operative who you're paying on an hourly basis to go door to door. Their heart's not in it, and they're not a neighbor. They don't have that credibility. So training candidates, training campaigners, and being on people's doorsteps, I think, is the key.
So you're doing that. Is the party doing that?
Well, there needs to be much more of that.
Right.
It's a big state. LA County is the population of Michigan. San Diego County is the population of Iowa. There's a lot more of it that has to be done.
Yeah.
And a presidential contest brings out so many people, so many volunteers.
Yeah, it's an opportunity.
This is the opportunity to plug those people in, and then keep them involved.
Yeah. We will see how that turns out. Fantastic to meet you.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed it.
My pleasure. I'll come on anytime.
All right, so look who's here. It's only the leader of the Republicans in the State Assembly, in our legislature. You know him, James Gallagher. Great to see you.
Good to be with you, Steve.
So let's start with the convention, where we are here. I mean, not every one of your colleagues comes to this. Why are you here?
Why am I here? I mean, this is where our delegates meet. This is where we discuss all of the latest issues as Republicans. Obviously, this year it's maybe even more special because we have all these presidential candidates that have come to town. But look, this is the kind of the heart of our party.
Uh-huh.
It's all the people who've been very involved from all across the state coming together as one to talk about ideas and how we can make our party stronger, how we can grow our numbers, how we can win elections, you know. And so to me, it's always been really exciting, you know, to be part of.
Because, you know, you do get a sense that there's a, I feel it, you know. I'm going around the state and speaking to county events and so on. And I do get this feeling, and maybe this is inevitable with all political parties, a sort of grumbling, you know, the grassroots grumbling at the leadership and grumbling, you know, And so in a way, it's just interesting because it feels to me like you're very much in touch with both. You're clearly leadership because you're the leader
right.
in the legislature, but you feel very grassroots in your orientation.
Yeah.
Just that's the sense I get from you.
I just feel as kind of what I've always been. I mean, I started out as a college Republican at Berkeley, you know,
right.
and attending these conventions, you know, with the college Republicans, and then coming up being part of a central committee myself. You know, so I've always been really involved with the party.
Yeah.
And I guess maybe it's just more natural, you know, for me. There is always some of that tension, right? And especially when you haven't been successful,
mm-hmm.
right? That people want to say, well, why haven't we been successful?
Mm-hmm.
And there's different ideas, and there may be conflict over, hey, well, what is the best way?
Mm-hmm.
That's actually okay, right?
Right?
Like, I think sometimes people get uncomfortable by that or something. It's like, well, you know, we do need to have conflict at times.
Yes.
We do need to have discussion, and we need to figure out what is, you know, the best way for our party. But we do that together, right? And we do that.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, look, it's a bit of a hammy kind of cliche, but I do think the family analogy is a good one. It's
yeah.
like you're a family, and there's no family on earth.
You argue with your brothers all the time.
Exactly. I mean, but you love each other, and it's a family, and you stick together. I think that's such an important thing to bear in mind because you do have these arguments. Let's talk about elections. This is a political conference, and so, you know, elections are always at the forefront. What are you looking for in this cycle? What are the priorities and the prospects?
So, as you know, I mean, I came in as leader in February of last year, and my biggest objective was to go on the offensive. Like,
yeah.
I'm tired of playing defense.
Yes.
I'm tired of us, like, you know, responding to what the Democrats do. Let's make them respond to what we're doing, you know? And I think we've been able to do that really effectively. You know, we did that on the fentanyl issue this year.
You did. I mean, this has been amazing. There's been real energy. I didn't want to interrupt, but I certainly see that.
Yeah, I mean, so we came out right off the bat and said, hey, why don't we pass these policies that get tough on dealers? That's who's killing our kids, right? They're selling them online or they're meeting at the mall and, hey, here, you know, take this pill, one pill, and they're dead, right? You know, they die overnight, and their parents had no idea,
mm-hmm.
you know? So why not go after these dealers? And we kind of made the Democrats be the ones to say no.
I know.
And we made them
amazing.
I think, very bad, right?
Yeah.
And then Shannon Grove did a great job championing the human trafficking legislation that said, look, why isn't it a serious felony to traffic a child, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, the Democrats did exactly what I knew they would do in the assembly. Once it got to the Public Safety Committee, these radicals killed the bill because they can't bring themselves to pass any new crime legislation,
yes.
right? And it got national exposure.
Yes.
We exposed them. So we've been doing that, and I think we've shown, you know, their vulnerable underbelly.
That's right. I think we've had a really good, you know, session. Is that what you were, you know, because you've really made waves.
Right.
And you've shown that even with, you know, it's a very big numerical advantage they have.
Right.
And I want to get to that in a second. But you've really kind of, what's the phrase, you know, punched above your weight with,
right.
you know.
Yeah, no, man, we're like, you know, Sugar Ray Robinson. And, you know, it's like, yeah, pound for pound.
Right.
I think we punched pretty well. And so now, I want to take advantage of that, right? Like, I want to go into this election cycle and make them pay, right?
Okay.
And we have some really good candidates that are emerging that are going to be running in assembly seats. And we plan to make this election all about those issues, right?
Okay, like, great.
The legislature. Yeah, right. And just go into every one of these seats and say, hey, it's the Democrats who have made your cost of living out of control, right? It's the Democrats who are the reason why we have encampments and needles and you can't even go to the park because of this stuff, right? It's the Democrats, you know, who have made it to where you have crime that's out of control, right? Or stealing from stores,
mm-hmm.
violently assaulting people on the streets, right? And we as Republicans want to change
that.
We want law and order. We want to cut your costs. We want to find ways to actually bring your costs down, not raise them like the Democrats are doing. And I think that message is going to be really compelling.
I completely agree. It's these very practical things that I think are the way, or we were just talking about it with Ron in a different context, but finding those points where there's an agreement. Okay, it's just practical. It's not, you know, ideological or partisan. It's like, this is like, we can't have this in our communities. It's ridiculous.
Right.
It's embarrassing.
Right.
And it's the result of policies. It's not like just, you know, force of nature.
Right.
It's amazing. Well, I wanted to ask you then about the prospects. You've got, what is it, 6119 in the legislature, right?
6218.
6218? Oh, what happened?
Yeah. So, we lost one seat Suzette Valladares by 500 votes.
Oh, my God.
500 votes. This was in Santa Clarita, San Fernando Valley.
Right.
We're going back there. We actually have a candidate running.
And so what do you think? So are all the seats up in 24?
They're all up in 24.
Okay. So what realistically, what do you think you could... What's your range of hope and expectation?
I think realistically we could pick up four seats.
Four.
And so that's what we're looking at. Last cycle, there were three seats that we won in which Joe Biden had won that seat in 2020. Our registration as Republicans was 33% or less.
Mm-hmm.
And the Prop 1, abortion initiative has passed, by 55%.
Mm-hmm.
We won in each of those seats because we had a good candidate.
Amazing.
And we ran a smart campaign. And we talked about exactly those issues.
Yeah.
Last cycle was really about gas prices. And that's still an issue, right?
Right.
I mean, look, gas is now over... almost $7 in a lot of parts of California.
Yeah.
So we think we can do that again. I want to put that on steroids. I'm out there raising even more money into that effort. We've been recruiting great candidates, like I said. In northern San Diego County, we got a great opportunity. Christy Bruce Lane is our candidate there. She almost defeated a 10-year Democratic incumbent last cycle.
Okay.
Came really close. She's running again. Got a lot of support. We got a Democratic poll leaked to us. The Democrats did a poll in that race. Got leaked to us. She's at 45%. The other Democrats are at 13-6.
Wow. That's
so
great.
By the way, we'll
get these candidates on so you can meet them because
I'd love
it's a really important part of our function on the show is to make sure that we give people a chance to meet those who are fighting for these changes. But what about, I'm just interested in that. Is this really your operation in terms of trying to win those seats? And how does it fit with the California Republican Party? So I had Jessica Milan Patterson on yesterday, and very often, and she's a lot of her effort goes into the congressional races, and which is all of course vital too, because Kevin McCarthy wouldn't be Speaker without California seats. So there's so much to do. It's such a big state.
Yeah, we all work together, but my focus is primarily on the Assembly seats, trying to increase Assembly seats.
So things like candidate recruitment, do you actually get involved in that person?
Yes, right. And I have a team, and in my caucus, I've also empowered different people. So Vince Fong is like...
Oh, yes, he's great.
Yeah. And Heath Flora is part of that effort as well.
Uh-huh.
Tom Lackey. So all of us kind of in the caucus, we all have different roles.
Yes.
But we've been out there. Our operation is about, recruiting great candidates and then looking at each of these races and saying, okay, where do we have some really good opportunities? Looking at the data. We have now 4 billion data points that are in-house at the party where we can actually help identify voters that are going to be with us on issues. So we're really focused on that. And then I'm out there, raising the resources.
It's exactly. I mean, the more time I spend on this, it's just really impossible to do anything without it. Just like you can't sell it in the private sector. You can't sell a product without thinking about the marketing.
It's exactly. Yeah.
Let's turn to the bills that have been. We're in that period of time of the year when these bills are just flowing out of the legislature. Huge.
Too many.
Avalanches of new legislation, and Gavin Newsom's made some headlines for vetoing a couple, three or four that were, you could say, surprising because he was actually vetoing left-wing measures, but generally he's signing off on all of, right?
Yeah.
Is anything good coming out of the legislature? And secondly, what are the real horrors that people need to be aware of?
Unfortunately, not really. they reported on this, like this was almost like the year of labor. Labor got pretty much everything they wanted, out of the legislature. So they passed a bill that like you can literally go on strike and collect unemployment benefits.
It's stunning.
Totally counterintuitive. And not only that, like we're at $18 billion deficit in our unemployment fund right now. So you're talking about adding more people onto that fund that aren't even, they're not unemployed.
There's no downside. Right. I mean, it's just, the whole thing is mad, actually. It's amazing to me. I make this point often because it feels like in some of this, in this particular area, we're either at or heading rapidly back to the kind of economics that you saw in the UK in the 1970s,
right,
before Margaret Thatcher's reforms, and they called it, the word that was used to describe was corporatism. And what it meant was that basically, and they used this word tripartite the whole time, they ran the economy with basically committees of the government, the unions and the company. And the company was like one third.
Right.
And that's sort of what's happening. I mean, that's the last food thing was that.
Well, and I mean, in this case, it's almost like they don't even put the company in the equation.
Right.
And, you know, they raise minimum wage, you know, for fast food workers. They may raise a minimum wage for hospitals and healthcare workers.
Yes.
Now, that sounds good. Like, yeah, of course, man, like our frontline healthcare workers, we want them to, you know, make good money and we want them to be compensated. But what that is going to result in is already we have rural hospitals that are failing. They're failing because of Medi-Cal and the failures of this.
Was it one in the Central Valley? Was it Madera?
Madera. Yeah, it's closed down.
Amazing.
You know, when you say, oh, now you're going to minimum, you have to pay, you know, that healthcare worker $25 an hour.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what that does to their costs? It skyrockets them.
And they
simply can't sustain that. And we're going to see more rural hospitals close down because of that flawed policy.
It's just really infuriating because I find on issue after issue, what you're seeing, and you mentioned it earlier, there's pressure for higher wages, and it's understandable.
Right.
Because the cost of living is going up.
Right.
Right. So, yeah, of course you can't afford your rent or a house or whatever, so pay me more. But instead of what they should be doing, which is lowering the cost of living so you don't get that pressure,
right.
It's just this ever-upward cycle. Because
they've only added to it.
I know, you raise the cost of living. Okay, God, we've got to raise the minimum wage. Yeah. That increases the cost of living for everyone else because
right.
Costs go up. It's totally added.
And then Newsom went to the climate summit last week and announced, I'm signing 253. He wanted something shiny to announce on the climate front. What that bill does is it makes all these companies have to report their climate emissions all the way through the supply chain. It's going to be very expensive, you know, and all that expense, who's going to pay for it? The California consumer, once again,
Zach,
to do really nothing about
it. No, actually, exactly.
Just to report.
It's just
on what is essentially less than 1% of the world's emissions. You're going to report on those things and increase everybody's costs. It's just foolishness, and they keep doing this over and over.
It is absolutely, it's so frustrating. It's just bureaucracy for its own sake, and it has a real effect on the real world.
Right.
So finally, just tell us your thoughts. You mentioned the presidential candidates being here. How do you see the presidential race playing into California politics this year?
Well, look, I think you got to see that, you know, President Trump is at the forefront. You know, I mean, he's, you know, polling very high in every state. He's polling high among Republicans, you know, here in California. But I think we also have a long way to go, you know, and like then these other candidates are just starting to get out there. The good news on our side is, man, we've got a lot of great candidates and every single one of them is better than Joe Biden, right?
Right.
I mean, Joe Biden is just collapsing. You know, his administration has been a total failure. No matter what Gavin Newsom maybe wants to say about this being a master class, you know, it's just ridiculous to me. I was like, any wage growth we've seen has been completely swallowed with
inflation.
That's his fault. We are weak in the world. Yeah. Afghanistan, total disaster, right?
Yes.
We are capitulating to China. You know, we're doing nothing to really stop the influence of China. We are not a leader in the world. Like, there's nothing that this guy's doing well. Kind of similar to Newsom, right? Like, his state's on fire.
Yeah,
right?
It's going well.
But he wants to tell everybody how great it is.
I know. It's amazing. But I hear some people say, well, whatever you think of Donald Trump and love him or hate, he's actually not that helpful in California to have him be the face of the Republican Party. Do you subscribe to that? I mean, who would be the best candidate for California?
Well, look, I mean, we've had a problem in California as Republicans, right? And that's what, you know, that's a lot of what we're talking about here is like, how do we get back? How do we get voters to vote for Republicans, mm-hmm. right? And I think it's about ideas. I mean, ultimately, I think that's what it's really about. It's not about one person or one candidate. Look, I mean, yeah, the reality is right now this PPIC poll just came out last week. And it shows that, you know, President Trump is very popular amongst our Republican voters. He's got 48% of the Republican vote.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you do a straight up one-on-one between him and Joe Biden, he has 27% statewide.
In California, right.
That's a reality, right? I mean, that is a reality. That's where we're kind of starting from, and we got to build on, right? And I don't know that it matters who it is, right?
Right.
I think what it really matters is, hey, are we connecting with voters in California?
Well, I think that's right. And to go back to where you started, you know, the specific issues that are really day-to-day things, and if we can show people that Republicans are fighting to actually make a difference on things like, as you have shown this in the last few months. I think that is, you know, it can easily override whatever national mood music there may be.
I kind of put, I mean, and this is maybe an oversimplification, but I think like California voters have felt like Democrats are cool.
Right.
Voting Democrat is cool.
Yeah.
You know, but it's becoming less cool, right?
Yes.
That phase, you know, that trend is starting to fade out.
Right. Interesting.
And that's an opportunity for Republicans to say, well, look, we've got a better way. Like, I know you're tired of this, right? You're tired of the crime. You're tired of the homelessness. Mm-hmm. You're tired of your cost of living going up. Well, let's do something different, you know,
yeah.
And we have to kind of, and that's our job. We have to show them that, hey, we've got a better option for you.
Yeah.
And you should actually start with us. We're going to be the new cool.
Right? Exactly. Well, it's a very nice, simple way of saying it.
Yeah.
If you don't like it, let's try something different. It's pretty basic.
Yeah.
Great to see you. Thank you very much.
Great to see you.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Thank you, Steve.